Ellen White says it was racism. She says that the reason why Adventists didn't go down south and minister to the blacks was because of racism and was because of rebellion against God. So all the reasons that we can give, Ellen White kind of steps in and says what it ultimately was. I think that all those other things feed into it, but she says that it was a rebellion against God.
The Lineage Journey Podcast, unscripted conversations that aim to help you on the journey of discovering your lineage. Join us as we take a deeper look into past lineage episodes and see the lessons we can learn for today.
Today we have a special guest joining us from Maryland. His name is Dr. Benjamin Baker. He is one of the foremost experts on the subject of Black history and Adventism, having done his PhD thesis on this at Howard University in Washington, D.C. I listened to a few of his presentations recently. He did one last year, especially during the height of the summer protest, that was fascinating, with some really, really profound insights into this aspect of Adventist history. So we're glad that he can join us today. And I believe as you listen to our interview today, you're going to hear things that maybe you haven't heard before and see Adventism in a different light, and aspects of our past that will shed light on what our identity as a church was in its inception and where we may have veered from that. Today we have joining us Dr. Benjamin Baker. He's joining us from Maryland. So welcome to you near the nation's capital. Hope you're keeping safe over there. And thank you for joining us over the airwaves and via this forum. As you know, I mentioned in the introduction, you're one of the foremost experts on the Black work, or how Adventism in the Black community started in the 1800s and through to the 1900s. So really appreciate your expertise on that. And just wanted to kind of delve into some of the aspects of that and some of the historical lessons we can learn and just see how Adventism grappled with that side of its early identity and so on. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so the first question I wanted to get into, just to get right into it, and you know, maybe in this age of, you know, really in the last year, we've had a lot of, you know, Black Lives Matter protests and the social justice movement's gotten big and so on. And I think, you know, I had read my fair share of Adventist literature maybe 10, 15, 20 years ago, but never really understood maybe how deep or the ways early Adventism was linked with the abolition movement. Would you like to maybe expand a little bit on that, how Adventism in its early days, like the 1840s and the 1850s, was linked with abolition and really what that means, you know, for our identity as Seventh-day Adventist?
Yes, a very good question. I think that the one of the best indicators of a fruitful area of history, and as historians we call it historiography, which is the process of doing history. We mainly do history from available documents, oral history interviews if the people are still alive, and other means. But one of the signs of a fruitful area of historiography is that you're still finding more on it. Mm-hmm. And many of us now are turning back to the Millerite period, the 1830s, and the 1840s, from which Seventh-day Adventism sprung. And with the really rise and dominance of the internet, we are finding myriad sources, myriad new sources now, you name it, newspapers, manuscripts, correspondence, you name it, linking the Millerite movement with the abolitionist movement. And in fact, Kevin Burton, who is my colleague and who I must give props to, he's now basically proven that the Millerite movement really arose thanks to the abolitionist movement.
Wow. So there's a strong connection.
Yes, strong connection. That is the networks of abolitionism, which were strong throughout New England and New York in the 1830s and 40s. Mm-hmm. Were what brought the Millerite movement to the fore. The newspapers, the gatherings, the house meetings, the churches, these were the areas that really promulgated and advanced William Miller's message. Of course, Miller himself was a staunch abolitionist. We know this, but then his lieutenants, other Millerite leaders like Joshua Himes, were just integral to the abolitionist movement. They started, they were involved in the Underground Railroad. They started abolitionist papers. They petitioned. They made abolitionist petitions. The Midnight Cry, all of the Signs of the Times, all of the Millerite newspapers almost doubled as abolitionist papers. They raised money for abolitionism. They got help for fugitive slaves. So the Millerite movement was absolutely inseparable from the abolitionist movement. You could rearrange pieces.
I find that fascinating.
Yes.
So you're saying that the network of abolitionists, you know, obviously there would be, it's an underground network, but that is part of what enabled William Miller's message to spread so quickly, because the same contacts and so on as well.
Yes, yes, definitely. In fact, we've often talked about Joshua V. Himes, is how he was a public relations wizard. He was a public relations genius. He learned these methods from the abolitionist movement.
Wow.
Because the abolitionist movement was all about drumming up support for, you know, the freedom of slaves.
Yeah.
And the ultimate freedom of slaves, ultimate emancipation, but also the Underground Railroad and political pressure. So it was all about networking. You know, if Himes was alive today, he would be on Twitter and Instagram and all this stuff, because it was all about networking. That was the whole game. And so it was moving the political needle in favor of the black slaves. So this was a ready-made infrastructure, a ready-made network that the Millerites took advantage of.
Wow.
Besides that, there were, I theorize that this is really what attracted so many blacks to the Millerite movement. And Adam, we are finding scores and scores of more blacks.
Wow.
Now that were Millerites, and they're beyond, they are the big names, but they're even beyond the big names, and just hundreds of blacks all along the Eastern Seaboard and even in the slave states. So we're finding black slaves who were Millerites, who before we kind of thought that Millerism was inimical to slavery, because, you know, obviously it tended to, we have evidence. We have newspaper reports of slaveholders who heard the Millerite message and they emancipated their slaves. They heard the Millerite message because of the Millerite message.
Wow.
We always thought that it was inimical to slavery, but it turns out that some of the masters on some plantations let their slaves believe, you know, the slaves heard of the Millerite doctrine of the soon second coming, and they believed it. I mean, they held to it.
Fascinating. So, I think I heard a previous podcast by yourself, or maybe one with yourself and Kevin Burson, where you mentioned that there's not much documentation on the Underground Railroad because it was underground. And so, you know, people weren't keeping records of you know, who was freeing the slaves, et cetera. But I appreciate that now we're maybe getting little snippets more. But I have heard, and you mentioned a few magazines there that are integral to the Millerite movement. I have heard that the Adventist Review, which is, you know, still in circulation today, is, you know, the review, I think it's called Adventist World, was banned in the South because of its strong abolitionist sentiments that were expressed in there. Could you give us kind of maybe some insight on that?
Yes, yes. A few of your points. As you said, the Underground Railroad was illegal. I mean, with the Fugitive Slave Act of 1798, and then was ratified and sort of morphed again in 1850. White says you should not obey the Fugitive Slave Act. This was illegal, and it caused you to be ostracized. It could result in jailing. It could result in fines. And so you didn't want to make it known that you were harboring fugitive slaves. So imagine how impossible it is. I mean, Adam, the whole Underground Railroad was built on secrecy. The whole thing. That was the only way that it could survive. And so to find evidence now that someone operated an Underground Railroad station, which is just opening up your house, opening up your barn, maybe your church, some area on your property, to a fugitive slave who's en route to probably Canada or Ohio. Mm-hmm. That's what it consisted of. So with people like John Byington, his brother Anson, George Irwin, Butler, some of these early GC presidents, what we're finding now is a cubbyhole, you know,
in the house.
And in a diary entry says that, you know, this escaped slave was here. And so this is how we're piecing it together. Hmm. Sometimes, you know, you have them outright saying it. But as far as the Adventist Review being banned in the South, the Confederacy was monitoring the mail because they didn't want any propaganda from the North that would sort of sway the people's opinion. And the Adventist Review was, you can say whatever you want about our founders, but it was constantly having screeds and constantly inveighing, condemning slavery and the Confederacy. That's one thing that it was doing all of the time. I mean, they were, in fact, James White said, every single Adventist voted for Lincoln. Now that seemed like some hyperbole, but you know, apparently he didn't know of one that did not vote for, every single voting Adventist had him. Adventists who could vote voted for Lincoln. And they're saying things like, Ellen White saying things like, Satan created the Confederacy. So things like that, the post carriers in the South could not, they were prohibited from carrying the Adventist Review.
Wow. Wow. I mean, to me, I find that fascinating. And I think for us as Adventists, it really says something about our early identity that our first GC president, you know, GC president is like, you know, using his farm on the railroad. And, you know, our early magazine was speaking out that boldly on these issues that it was, you know, it was censored and it was banned.
But one point on that, because people now think that it was a done deal and everyone in the North was against slavery. That is not the case at all.
Yeah, true.
Not the case at all. Whole churches were splitting over the issues, some pro-slavery, some anti, and this is in the North. And so it still took courage, and it cost politically, as we see with the sort of what Adventists reaped after emancipation. They had a hard time in the South because of the stance they took on slavery and because they were so vocal with it. So I mean, there was a price.
Do you know what were some of the was there certain denominations that were kind of pro-slavery, and even though they were in the North and Adventism was a kind of different from them, or was it hard? Is it hard to put on denominational lines?
Yeah, Southern Baptists, certain Methodists, Presbyterians, really all of the denominations, some part of their church split and was on the side of slavery.
Okay.
So I would say almost every single denomination, I'm not sure about the Catholics, but basically all of the major Protestant denominations, you know, you have the smaller ones like maybe the Church of God, maybe the Christian Connection, things like that. They didn't split, the Quakers, they didn't split, but the large ones, Baptists, Methodists, Presbyterians, Episcopalians, they a significant amount of them split because of slavery.
So in some ways, I think, would you be of agreement that the Adventist church and movement, part of it was, you know, this was another piece of restoring the image of God to those they were witnessing to in terms of a stand that they had to take?
Yes, definitely. I think that's one part of our message that's lost sight of, that we were the finishers, if you will, of the Reformation. And that the Protestant Reformation was not a discrete event, but it was a odyssey, it was a journey. And we're like, I mean, this sounds hubristic, it sounds arrogant, but we are the completers of it. Because we're supposed to totally you know, remove ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So Martin Luther started it, maybe even before then.
Mm.
We are finishing it. And I think that a key part of it is the racist piece.
Mm.
You know, treating everyone with dignity and respect and in the image of God.
Mm. Maybe just want to go back a little bit and talk about maybe one specific episode of early Millerite Adventist history. And you mentioned about, you know, there were some prominent Blacks involved in the work. And I've read a book by your father called The Unknown Prophet. And we did a lineage episode on William Foy and Hazen Foss, just comparing one who was faithful and one who was unfaithful. And in some circles, you know, when I was, before I'd read the book, I heard some people say that, oh, you know, he rejected the gift or et cetera, et cetera. But I believe your father correctly points out that he didn't, and he shared faithfully what God had given to him and so on. Just maybe some, I don't know, maybe just kind of pick your brain a little bit on William Foy a little bit. You know, why do you think maybe like he was a, I don't know, like I've sometimes wondered why his ministry kind of didn't continue beyond the Great Disappointment and go further than that. Yeah.
That's a good question, Adam. You see that God seemed to have, I don't know what God, he seems to be an equal employment God.
Amen.
Because there's William Foy, who's Black. There's Hazen Foss, who's white. And then there's Ellen White, who's a woman. And these are the major demographics at the time in that area. You know, mm-hmm. the northeastern quadrant of North America. And so God apparently had a ministry for each of them. And I don't know, Adam, about their contingency.
Mm.
So if Hazen Foss had been faithful, would Ellen White have come along? I don't know.
Yeah,
but we do know that in the Bible that there were myriad prophets operating even at one time.
True.
And they each had their own ministry. So this is what my father theorizes about William Foy, that he was called to guide the believers up to that October 22 point, essentially.
Hmm.
And that after that, Ellen White kind of took over. It's always interesting to look at people who say that he rejected the call because he actually published a pamphlet.
Yeah.
So it's like, how did he not share his visions when he actually published a pamphlet? And even John Loughborough and Ellen White say that he had, because in his pamphlet, he shared two of his visions. But John Loughborough and Ellen White said that he had a third and a fourth.
Hmm.
So he was, they wouldn't know that unless he shared,
mm-hmm.
shared the visions. And Loughborough even describes his third. And so he was faithful to the call. As to why he didn't continue, I have no idea.
Mm.
That's beyond me. But we do know from eyewitness testimonies that he talked about all four of his visions, but he didn't understand the third and the fourth, which seemed to indicate the three angels' messages,
mm.
which really occurred after Babylon fell.
Mm-hmm.
And the everlasting gospel. So that seemed to be sort of Seventh-day Adventism.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't understand that. And so he would talk about it, but it sort of took some of the wind from his sails because he didn't comprehend it like he did the first and the second.
Mm.
So, you know, that's probably the best I can give about that.
Mm. Well, I think he had a key ministry that served the church, the believers at that time. And, you know, like you say, some of the other questions or answers we don't have, and we trust God for that. So the early Adventism, we've got abolition, we've got people on the Underground Railroad. I mean, the first GC president would have been in the 1860s, who was Underground Railroad. So we have, and then Lincoln is, you know, around the same time, and you know, we had the Civil War around the same time, and Adventists are pitching themselves on the sides of abolition, and Ellen White had several visions about, you know. Against slavery and against racism, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we kind of have this picture that Adventism is cutting edge. I guess you'd say it's countercultural. It's different. Our pioneers are abolitionists and so on. And then Ellen White writes a book or publishes a book called The Southern Work. So, I mean, if Adventists were already, in a sense, countercultural or abolitionist or cutting edge, why was this just a continuation of that, where Ellen White is now emphasizing the Southern work, or was it, did we kind of slack off and so she needed to remind the believers? Where do you see that book, Southern Work, fitting in the progression?
Yeah, yes, that is the question. I would say that, and this is not to cast any aspersions on the South, but Adventists were doing great. And this is actually, Adam, when Arne Bontemps, you know, the great poet of the Harlem Renaissance. Once he grew up Adventist, he taught at Oakwood, taught at Harlem Academy. But this is how he characterized Adventists. He said, we did great in the early years, but then Adventism went south and we became raped. So that's how he characterized it. And I submit to that characterization. The South was sort of a tornado on Adventism because all the blacks were there, Adam. I mean, what, you may have had, what, 5% in the North, maybe less than that. And so all the blacks were South. And so in order to reach blacks, you had to go into that fraught and problematic culture of the Confederacy. And this is during Reconstruction. And so Adventists were, I mean, I don't want to compare it to anything today because I may be politically incorrect, but it's like going to a totally different culture that you were antagonistic toward and that you were condemning all the time in your paper. And as James White says in a very, I really want to send you this, in a very interesting article, he says, we were born because they were reacting to the South. Because some of the former Confederates, they had Confederate generals in their houses, pictures of them in their houses. And James White said, we kind of need to understand where these people are coming from. Me, my wife, Joseph Bates, others, we were born in the North and were anti-slavery from the very start. This is how we were raised. James White actually says that. It's a very interesting article.
Wow.
But he says they weren't. They were raised totally different. And so Adventism, their Northern culture is so different from the South that in order for evangelistic success, they had to yield to some of the Southern mores, like segregation. And so all of Ellen White's statements that seem to be racist and seem to promote separation of the races, what have you, those are in the context of trying to evangelize and reach people in the South. Because when those racial principles or policies were not observed by Adventists, when they were flouted by Adventists, even mildly, like Elmira Steele had an orphanage and she was a white woman and she had black kids in the orphanage. And they said, oh, you're nigger lover and you're race mixing. Even mild things like that, Elmira Steele got her orphanage burned down.
Wow.
Edson and the Southern Missionary Society got basically run out of the South. You know, there was a, there was guns and all that stuff, so they got run out. And so some of Ellen White's statements, even in Southern Work, are a reaction to that. She's a church leader who wants the church members to be safe, and she wants the gospel to go to the South. And so it wasn't happening when the Northerners were just coming there and just flouting all principles of racial separation. So when you read Southern Work, most of it, like 80, 75% of it, is just awesome statements on race and our equality in Christ and all of that. But like 20, 25% of it is we may need to observe in certain places the separation of the races just so that we can have evangelistic success and that we can reach people with the gospel who need it. So those who are reading Southern Work, they'll read some really great things, but then there'll be some troubling things and those need to be contextualized.
What percentage, maybe you don't know this, but I mean, throwing a question at you on population, would you say of the South was black at the time? Like the majority of the blacks were in the South. Was a majority of the population in the South black as well, or were they still the minority to whites in the South? In the
90s, I would say 30 or 40%.
30-40% were black. Okay, yeah, so it's
part of the, like, if you go really in the black belt in the deep south, like Mississippi is probably like 40%.
Wow.
But if you go upper south, like Tennessee, Kentucky, I'm thinking 30% around there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, with the emancipation, there were about 4 million blacks emancipated.
Okay. So Ellen White had a son, or she had a couple of sons, and Edson White, you know, her son was a bit of a rebel. Anyway, he read the Southern Work, and he builds a boat up in Michigan and sails it across the Lake Michigan and then makes his way down the Mississippi, I believe it was. And yeah, I know you just referenced it right now that he had a few problems and was run out of a few places with pistols and whips and other types of things. But I remember I was at Oakwood a couple of years ago, and there's a house there, something called Morning Star or something, and they've got a heritage room where I believe they've got the wheel or something of the Morning Star there. So it's had the Morning Star boat had a big impact on the work. Could you share some of the impact the boat and had on short term at the time, but also the longer reaching impact of that boat on the black work in America?
Yes. By the way, have you listened to my video called The Separation of James and Ellen White? I just put up a video on YouTube on The Separation of James and Ellen White. And it's interesting you mentioned that Edson was a rebel, because they were having some marital trouble, James and Ellen. And there's a lot of reason why you have marital problems, but Edson was kind of at the center of it.
Yeah. I'm familiar with that, like how they dealt with him. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So parenting. So it's interesting how God... And this is perhaps hope for some of your listeners. You know, if you have a child who's a rebel, if you're a rebel yourself, God has a place for you in his work. Mm-hmm. And it may be an unorthodox place where you, because, you know, everything about the Morning Star ministry was sort of, you know, honed for a rebel.
Yeah.
You know, it was kind of perfect for a rebel. But the Morning Star, you're right. James Edson White had come across his mother's Our Duty to the Colored People speech. Speech she gave in 1891. And he also heard of some other people who had gone south. And so he got it into his head, and he teamed up with a man named Will Palmer. Mm-hmm. Edson's wife as well, Emma. And I always mention Emma because she got malaria in the south. And she ultimately ended up dying from malaria complications years later. So she's like a martyr. And this was another thing. It wasn't just racism that was stopping Northern Adventists from going south. It was a horrible environment for white people with the heat and the malaria. I mean, they would remark on this. They're like, this is no place for white people, you know, with the malaria and all that stuff. You know, the Africans who come from the tropics, they're fine here, but not the white people. I mean, this sounds politically incorrect now, but that's the sort of things that they were saying. And so they came up with a boat because it was mobile. Mm-hmm. And because they knew that they would have to go from place to place because they may experience persecution. And so that's exactly what happened. They went from place to place on the Mississippi. In a word, Adam, the Morning Star Ministry, and it's the Southern Missionary Society, that's the name of the ministry, really, once Ellen White got behind it and once some of the other leaders, you know, glommed onto it, Edson in his way was very controversial, and he ruffled a lot of feathers. But eventually there was some denominational support for it. But that was in many ways a foundation of the black work. Because there were feeder schools that were started. Some say that it sort of created an environment for Oakwood. I think that it was somewhat a part. Mm-hmm. But eventually the Southern Union was formed because Edson went to Nashville, sort of built off that work. Message Magazine was started, which was originally the Gospel Herald, which Edson started.
Uh-huh. And that still runs today.
Yeah, and so many ministers, like Matthew Strawn, and just so many others, Alfonso Berry, came to the faith because of the Morning Star in that ministry. And so it was extremely foundational and important to the black work. At the same time, a lot of us are kind of moving away from the white savior myth.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about that. Yeah.
Well, we're just kind of complicating it because they had extensive Black help, from Finnis Parker, who helped to navigate, to show them how to get different places in the South on the Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And he was Black, and he was captaining the Morning Star. And it was against the law for Blacks to captain boats on the Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And so when another boat came down, Finnis kind of had to duck out of the way. And then Edson or Will Palmer took over.
Okay.
And so, you know, that's sort of like a metaphor. The Blacks had to get out of the way, and then the whites kind of take all the credit. Mm-hmm. But Nate Olvin and so many other people who were involved in the Southern Missionary Society and the Morning Star sort of helped it to be the success that it was. It was short-lived too. It was like 5 years.
Okay.
So it was a short-lived ministry, but it was far reverberating in its impact.
Would you say, like you've mentioned some of the Blacks on the boat at the time, would you say it was kind of a symbiotic relationship between them, in that the Blacks couldn't have done that work at the time on their own, and the whites likewise couldn't have done that on their own? They needed kind of the help of each other, but maybe we haven't given due credit where it's due on both sides, on one side.
Yes, definitely. Well said. I totally agree. It's the Morning Star, the Morning Star crew, the Southern Missionary Society, they needed Black assistance. And of course, back then, whites had more cachet. Mm-hmm. In Black areas, just because that's the way it was with you know, slavery and all that stuff. And so there was symbiosis in their relationship, definitely. Mm.
Would you say that the work that Edson and his crew did was a pioneering work? Were they the first ones down there? I know there was a dynamic time. There was a lot of things happening across, you know, the South is a huge area, but were they the pioneers there, or were they just kind of the first big one down there?
Yeah, as far as I know, they were the first ones in Mississippi where they went, like Yazoo City, Vicksburg, Antonia. They were the first ones there. Even though it's interesting, in that area, there was a man, his name is escaping me, something Parker, I think. And he was something of a prophet. Before Edson and his team arrived, he said to the inhabitants of this is like almost like biblical, to the Black inhabitants of Yazoo City, he said, they kind of rejected his message at him. And so he said, somebody greater than me is coming. And then the Morning Star comes in, you know, the Morning Star boat comes in. I can send you more about that story. Hmm. So there were sort of witnesses before them. Mm-hmm. As far as I know, they were the first in deep Mississippi, and in many places along the Mississippi, they were the first. But there were a lot of other people in the South, but it was very peripatetic. It was, you know, get here, do a meeting, go there, do a meeting, go there, do a meeting. And there wasn't much sustained growth like with the Morning Star.
So, I mean, just kind of looking at maybe the growth of the work. So they go down there, they start some, I guess there's some schools that come up, and you said that there's the Southern Union, the Southern Publishing work. Was the Southern Union originally, you know, for the Black work, or was it just kind of, did it just cover the whole of the South?
I would say that the Southern Union came from it. I guess the Southern Conference would be first.
Okay.
The Southern Union. But that's a good question. It was multiracial, but I would say largely from the start, it was Blacks and a lot of poor whites.
Okay.
Because that was really the main population at the time in the South. You see all of Ellen White's testimonies about how we should go for the better classes sometime. Mm-hmm. 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 Better classes. And the rich and all that stuff. So that was something that Adventists had to focus more on. But I would say from the beginning, it was mostly Blacks and poor whites, although there were others. But with the start of the Southern Conference, before there was like a loose sort of inchoate organization of District Number 1, District Number 2, District Number 3, and then it became the Southern Conference and then the Southern Union. But Edson there, of course, they started a publishing house, Southern Publishing. Mm-hmm. As I said, you know, the usual Adventist agenda, publishing, medical with Riverside Hospital, a conference office, and food. They had education, with Oakwood and other schools. And so it was the usual Adventist modus operandi.
Who was the first black minister in the South? Was it someone kind of from the Morning Star? Was it separate to that?
I would say the first black minister was separate from the Morning Star. It was probably Harry Lowe.
Okay.
In Wrightsville Junction, Tennessee, which is near Nashville. But he was more associated with Silas Osborne, who first did ministry down there. And then there was Charles Kinney was rather early.
Oh yeah, Charles Kinney
in Reno, Nevada, but then he ended up winding his way south. And there were some others. And so this is significantly, this is probably 15, 20 years before the Morning Star went south.
Okay.
Yeah.
So at this time when these ministers start, were they employed as ministers by the church in the early years, these pioneer ministers?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. And I just thought of another one, Alfonso Berry. Alfonso, and he was in Louisville, Kentucky. It's sort of interesting, the salary of early Adventist ministers. It was very unreliable. And so sometimes when you talk about pay or were they employed, there was sort of a loose relationship. They definitely didn't receive benefits. In fact, that's sort of a sketchy area of Adventist history about the ministers receiving the benefits. Their salary was sort of based on tithes and offerings, which was not always consistent, didn't always get to them. But Charles Kinney was employed. Alfonso Berry was employed. Harry Lowe was probably classified as a lay minister.
Okay.
He had a trade, but he was also the head minister of the church.
Lineage is a nonprofit organization kept running by generous donors like you. Support us today on patreon.com/lineagejourney.
History shapes identity. Identity shapes mission, and a clear mission determines the trajectory of your future. Knowing where you come from is key to understanding your present purpose and your future mission. Lineage Journey is a series of videos that will take you on a journey through time, discovering the key people and events that have shaped the Christian faith. From the Waldenses to Martin Luther to Zwingli, from England to France, Switzerland to Germany, the light broke over the horizon of Europe, piercing through the Dark Ages, and then spread out over the world. As the United States of America rose to supremacy, Christianity formed the bedrock of this great nation. And so from the Great Awakening to the Great Disappointment and beyond, Lineage follows the journey of God's church throughout time, immersing you in the places, the stories, and the people through whom Christianity has shone the brightest. Join us on a journey through time. Follow us on social media at Lineage Journey, or check out our website at lineagejourney.com. Lineage Journey not only produces video content, but instructive and illuminating resources to teach young and old about Christian history. Lineage has produced an educational coloring book for people of all ages. It includes original artwork from Ashley Bloom, highlighting the various heroes of the Reformation. Each scene has a matching story, and there are also QR codes to connect you to the website for more information and to watch the videos. There are also fun facts and memorable quotes to accompany the scenes to color in. Designed for young and old alike, get your copy now at lineagejourney.com.
What about the other denominations in the South? Were Adventists kind of pioneers in, like, you know, if we were like up north and we were early Adventist Millerites and then early Seventh-day Adventists were kind of countercultural in the sense that they were abolitionists, et cetera, et cetera. You know, slavery is now abolished, but, you know, conditions haven't changed much. What, was it seen as a ripe kind of hunting ground for evangelism to head to the South by all denominations, or were Adventists ahead of the game, or were we just kind of, was everyone else down there as well at the time?
Yeah, everyone else was down there. In fact, Ellen White says, we're like the last ones. Ellen White says, the other denominations have beat us to it. And this was a little bit what was behind, a little bit of what was behind her when she says, sin rest upon us because we're not doing more for the blacks in the South. And she says, we haven't touched one hundredth of the South. She said that like in the early 1900s. And she talked about how the monies that were raised for the Southern work by Adventists, they were being defrauded and misappropriated by church leaders, and it was racism. And so we were way behind. I mean, this is one area, this is not like health reform or something else we can say, oh, we were years ahead. We were way behind, and Ellen White is constantly bringing this. In fact, it seems like she's trying to shame Adventists because she said, look at how much the Catholics have done, you know, down there. And she says, you know, we're like the last. And so I would say that we were very much much behind, unfortunately.
So, I mean, maybe going back to a point you made earlier, I mean, we started off abolition and then I think you made the point that when we went south kind of, you know, figuratively speaking.
That's pretty good. Adam, please let me use that. That's pretty good. That's pretty good.
I mean, is it that the reality of what we'd been talking about was a lot harder or? I mean, it wasn't an easy work.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of explanations, and they may just be just that. They may be, you know, hemming and hawing. But the church had only incorporated in 1863.
True, yeah.
It was a brand new church, and that aligned with the Emancipation Proclamation. And so I've often said that the odyssey of African Americans has really aligned with the Seventh-day Adventist Church. And we've kind of grown up together, as it were. But the church had, there was about, 3,500 Adventists, Seventh-day Adventists, when it was incorporated. And we were also kind of getting over the war. In fact, Kevin Burton has come up with Civil War stats, and he's figured out that the Adventist rate of joining the Civil War kind of aligned with the nation's. And so the Adventist men of age served in roughly the same ratio as the national average, you know, in the Union, in the North. Mm-hmm. And so we kind of were getting over that as well. We were just really realizing that we were supposed to preach the gospel to the whole world. So there were all of these things. Of course, there were growing pains. I don't think people realize how disputed at times the prophethood of Ellen White was.
True. Yeah.
I mean, so there was just all sorts of things. There were scandals. There was a Snook and Brinkerhoff scandal right around 1863. And so we were getting attacked from all over. The church was new. It didn't have many political connections. And there just weren't many missionaries or ministers.
True. Yeah.
And so, you know,
I guess we were starting world missions as well. We were going to Europe and other places. So it was,
yeah,
you know, you could say we're stretched thin.
Yeah, John Andrews goes to Switzerland in early 1870s, and they go on to England, and so there's a lot happening. But Adam, I must say this, that Ellen White says it was racism. She says that the reason why Adventists didn't go down south and minister to the blacks was because of racism and was because of rebellion against God. So all the reasons that we can give, Ellen White kind of steps in and says what it ultimately was. I think that all those other things feed into it, but she says that it was a rebellion against God.
I mean, maybe that kind of goes into the next question I was going to ask, and that, you know, once the work started and progressed, it started to flounder a little bit. But then you've mentioned a little bit that when they went to the South, it led to the need for a more separate work as opposed to maybe being integrated.
Yeah, it was much better for blacks to work for blacks and whites to work for whites. Hmm. That's just the way it was. You know, the term haters. Mm-hmm. When whites work for blacks, and let alone blacks working for whites. But when whites worked among blacks in the South, haters came from all over. Hmm. There were whites hating against the whites. There were blacks hating against the whites. And they were saying, when you come down here and talk to blacks, you're making it worse for all of us. Hmm. Because there was persecution and general animosity toward blacks when whites came and tried to improve the lot of blacks. Hmm. Even without the gospel, just education or teaching them trades. Because mm-hmm. remember, there was a competition between blacks and poor whites. Hmm. And so when Adventists came from the North and they were working among blacks, whites would get jealous. They would see it as upsetting the delicate balance in the South, and it would go sideways, you know, all the different ways you can imagine it. And so what Ellen White was trying to do from the very beginning, and you'll see this constantly in her writings, she's saying, let's train up black ministers to work for blacks. Mm-hmm. And this has often been cited as, you know, she's being racist. You know, you'll see some of these internet sites and all that stuff saying she's being racist. But that was basically the only way it could work in the South during Reconstruction and after.
I mean, maybe we don't have time to get into this, and I think maybe it would be good to have another discussion when we talk about this more. But I think one thing people outside North America grapple with is, I think, understanding the climate of the late 1800s and early 1900s is one thing, and the need for something that was separate then. I think some people struggle with the continued separate structure that we have, you know, 100 years on, and wonder if there is another option. But I know that's a heated debate, and maybe don't want to
get into it. We can get into it.
Yeah, maybe another time. Because I know the history of that and how that all started is quite a fascinating and insightful history that maybe not everyone knows. But yeah. I mean, what do you think as Adventists, I mean, an application for us today is, you know, if we look at the 1840s and 30s, as you mentioned, and even beyond, and how we were, in a sense, cutting edge. What was it about the way we viewed scripture or the way we interpreted it that led us to do that? And what would, how do we... Is there I don't want to get political or bring up things today necessarily, but how can we have that same edge to us today, or where the church is relevant in not just, you know, the pulpit, but also outside?
Yeah, well, one of the key things I think that has torpedoed us as a church is that we've been accepted. Mm. As much as we have been accepted. I understand that in some places, Adventism, it's still, you know, people may think of us as a cult or something like that. But I think by and large, we are accepted and respectable. Mm-hmm. You know, the most diverse church in America, we have the strongest educational empire, or, you know, the vast educational empire. And now, Adam, in the States, you see Advent Health everywhere now.
Yeah, I'm saying the NBA.
In fact, you know, the NBA, you know, during the bubble last year, they were doing interviews and Advent Health was all behind it. So I think Advent Health was sponsoring the bubble.
Yeah.
You know, they're in Orlando. And so we have acceptance. And even in the 1950s, you know, with questions on doctrine and all that mm-hmm. stuff, we were accepted then. So before we were accepted, I think that we were more apt to speak truth to power because our acceptance wasn't on the line. We weren't politically connected. We could still speak truth to power, speak against the American government, and we said some harsh things against America, and that has been suppressed. We've stopped that, Adam. We have stopped that. But we said some really truthful things about America from prophecy, because this was before we were accepted, and really acceptance oftentimes is like the death knell
of a denomination,
Christianity and the present truth and the straight gospel. And so this acceptance really, you know, it got us comfortable and we became a part of the warp and woof. I mean, for many years, we were seen as the true Americans. You know, Adam was like American, like an apple, because, you know, we are an American derived religion, denomination. And so I would say it was that acceptance that definitely tamped down our message and made it a lot tamer. I would also say, and this is, there's nothing that we can do about this, but the more organized you get, the less you speak the truth.
It's true.
I mean, if I put it as boldly as that. So when we were not really that organized and some of our doctrines were still up in the air, some of our policies were not established, we didn't have a nice headquarters here and there. We just spoke the straight truth. Once we became organized, it was almost there became a party line. And with that party line was political acceptance. And if you say this, you may lose the government funds. The government subsidies. And so, you know, these are some of the things that I think of. I mean, come on, the pioneers were young.
Yeah.
1850, yeah. You know how it, Adam, when you're young, you can go for it. But then once you get middle aged and older, somehow the message is watered down.
It's true.
Things, but you know, that's how I would respond to your question. It's a good question. It's a great question.
Maybe I'd like to ask you, maybe as we wrap things up, what would you say? And I'm sure you've been asked this question before. You've dealt with this issue that people say Adventism, you know, it was kind of racist at the start, or Adventism is racist, or they say things like that, and they point to various episodes of our history. But I mean, for me personally, when I look at certain of our early beginnings, you know, we don't have that. But what would you say to someone who grapples with, you know, Adventism being, you know, being racist or being out of touch in terms of our early identity? I mean, how do you help someone maybe see around that or through that?
Yeah. It's interesting because at some point, and this is very traceable, and there are a lot of elements to it. At some point, we were way behind Adam. That is the truth. In fact, you know, General Katzenberger, the U.S. Secretary of Education or something, he had to cajole Adventists in the 1960s to desegregate their schools. And he said, this is the law. You have to do it. And so this is how behind we were. And you can look at many instances of Adventist history that are flat out racist. And there's really no explanation for it. But what I would say is a couple of things. Number one, you can always find, hopefully the Adventist majority, but definitely pockets who were prophetic and who were not racist during the hard times. Like, for instance, I often talk about how Black Adventists didn't have the luxury of not being involved in politics. Because, I mean, that was their community. That was directly their community. And so they were always engaged. And certain whites were always progressive and helping Blacks. So I would say you have to have some selective, but I mean, why can't we just use the past as a learning tool and say, we are apt to racism, to the sin of racism, like everyone else. So let's do double to not succumb to that. I mean, we can use that as a learning tool. I can't paint the past and say that we were great on race relations during this period and that period. But I can say that our past is rich with lessons. And so when we were great with it, you know, condemning slavery and all of this, we can learn from that. And when we were not good on it, when we were behind everybody else, we can also learn from that.
Yeah, thank you. I think that's wise words. There were, like you say, there's episodes of our history where we were ahead of the game, and there's episodes where we were far, far behind. And we need to learn from both and chart out a future for ourselves personally, but also against a wider denomination and Christianity today as well. So Thank you. Thank you for your insights, and thank you for joining with us. I know there's a whole lot more we could talk about. And for those who are just getting, you know, maybe this is the first time you're hearing a discussion on some of these topics, and I hope it's been insightful too for those of you who have looked at it before. I pray that it's been interesting as well. I believe you have a YouTube channel. Is it Black SDA History?
BlackSDAHistory.org. I also have a website, BlackSDAHistory.org. That is under construction right now.
Okay.
But the website is going strong, BlackSDAHistory.org on YouTube.
Okay.
And the website's under construction now. So.
Well, thank you for joining us. And for those of you who are listening, if you want to interested in watching any of the Lineage episodes on this, we have one called Adventist and Abolition. We have another one called Ellen White and the Civil War, and another one that looks at the issue of slavery as well. So you can find those on our YouTube channel, Lineage Journey on YouTube. Thank you for joining us. Thank you, Dr. Baker, for taking the time to be with us. Really appreciate it, and for sharing your insights and for, you know, ministering wider than this podcast. Wherever you go, we thank you for the ministry that you do and for sharing on this important topic. Thank you.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And for those listening, we pray God may bless you. And thank you for joining us on this episode of the Lineage Journey podcast.
Thank you for listening. We hope that you enjoyed this episode. Lineage Journey is supported by your generous donations. Did you know that you can donate on a monthly basis? Any amount from $2 to $100 or whatever you decide through patreon.com/lineagejourney. Your donations go towards the cost of producing our varied content, and we thank you for your support.